Welcome to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. The fictioneers, the artists, the editors, and others. Brought to you by the PulpNet. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at the PulpNet. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at thepulp.net.
About 2019, I was searching on the internet when I came across this book. My dad had been dead for 15 years, and suddenly he published his second book. I mean, it was like he was resurrected. Matt invited me to begin to attend these pulp conventions, which I'd never heard of before. Didn't realize it was a group of people who were so interested in this kind of literature. I mean, it astounded me fast, and still does. I mean, I find it amazing, interesting, fantastic.
In this episode of Pulp Tales, author John Woolley talks with Peter Woolson about Woolson's father, fictioneer Morton Woolson. Morton Woolson wrote for the pulp magazines, including Black Mask and Dime Detective magazine, under the name of Peter Page. This Pulp Tales was recorded at Pulp Fest 2024 in Pittsburgh on Saturday, August 3rd, 2024. John begins.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. And first of all, you may be asking yourself, what is a Beverly Hills psychoanalyst doing at Pulp Fest? And the answer is that this is Dr. Peter Woolson, and he is the son of Morton Woolson, who was Peter Page. And so tonight we're going to talk a little bit about your dad, man.
Yeah.
So we start out, go ahead, we start out with the Matt Moring's first Cash Whale collection. And this is kind of one of the reasons, I guess, why you're here, this collection, right?
Exactly.
All right, go ahead and let us know about
it. I mean, I had no idea of these pulp conventions, nothing about them at all. And I was, about 2019, I was searching on the internet when I came across this book. My dad had been dead for 15 years, and suddenly he published his second book. I mean, it was like he was resurrected. So I got the book, I looked at the introduction, written by this gentleman here, fabulous introduction, contacted him. And he put me in contact with Matt Moring. And Matt invited me to begin to attend these pulp conventions, which I'd never heard of before. Didn't realize it was a group of people who were so interested in this kind of literature. I mean, it astounded me fast, and still does. I mean, I find it amazing, interesting, fantastic, actually. And so I attended one at Walker Martin's house, the first one, and his house is like a veritable pulp museum. Matt, I attended the Chicago Pulp and Paper convention, and then this one, Pulp Fest last year. And Mike Chomko was kind enough to say, hey, why don't you give a presentation about your dad? And so that's why I'm here right now. And I feel very grateful to be here. I feel like my father's come alive again just by having this opportunity. And Matt published a second volume of Cash Whale. My dad wrote about 20 Cash Whale stories. Altogether, he wrote about 56 pulp fiction stories. And he published one book in 1988, The Nightmare Blonde, based upon a short detective story he wrote called Softly Creep, Softly Kill. And another publishing company, Encyclopocalypse Publications, just recently republished that book on July 16th. So that was great. My dad had about three or four unpublished novels He had a number of unpublished stories. So I'm in the process of trying to get them published. And all of it is like revitalizing him. It's like bringing him to life again for me, which is just exceptionally meaningful and important. So that's how I got here.
Okay, you want to show us a couple of early pictures of your dad as we go along?
Yeah, let's show the first picture. My dad here is 2.5 years old, and he's of Russian-Ukrainian Jewish origin. I guess in those days they were setting up their kids a little bit like this. And his father, you know, it looks like he's this winged angel here. His father writes this about him, and apparently he insulted his father. He said something incomprehensible, because I tried looking it up in Russian and Ukrainian, nobody could translate it. So it must have been, "I'll hit you. Well, blonde little rascal, after all, you're on the right track. You justify my expectations. Whatever your vocation will be, one thing I am sure of, you have red blood in your veins and plenty of it. Meekness and submission are not in your line, little rascal. True enough, you are a disturber of the peace at times. You have your own peculiar original desires and want them filled at any price. But you are entitled to everything you demand because your consent was not asked for bringing you here. We brought you here, immaterial what the motive was, and we are under obligation to make you happy. I am proud of the fact that you display no symptom of gentleness, as there are already so many gentlemen and so few men. I wish you, when you grow up, that you can afford to say what he said in the beginning, Gesagt, whenever you feel like, just as freely as you do it now. So, with this kind of influence, my dad had a very kind of supportive, indulgent, parental experience. My grandmother, he was the first child of this family of like four siblings, and he basically walked on water. He was like the god that was born into this family. So this was his father. His father came to this country, an immigrant. He organized Italian women who were making dolls for their children to work for him. And he called his company Associated Toy and Doll Factories. And it became a successful doll manufacturing business. He had a showroom in the Toy Center of Manhattan, right across from Gramercy Park, where the Eternal Light is. And he was a charismatic salesman. He could sell the pants off of anybody. Very proud. So this is his mother, Zena Wolson, and she came here. She was the first to come from Russia to this country, worked in the sweatshops in New York City, saved enough money to bring her entire family over, including her father. And speaking pidgin English, she attended Fordham University, a Catholic university, won the highest honors in chemistry, and probably would have also won the honors in history, according to her professors at that time. She then got her own pharmacy, long before women had pharmacies, and women, you know, they wouldn't be respected. You know, you'd only go to a male pharmacist at that time. And we are talking about the early 1920s. But she did very well as a pharmacist. Let me give you the prelude to this. This is Mort's dad's Morton Wilson. This is his picture as a bouncer at the New York 1939 World's Fair. He had, in his youth, he was always writing. As a child, he wrote. He wrote in high school. He was in a class with my mother, and they were required to write a paper. He wrote a paper. The teacher said, "This is plagiarized." He said, "No, I wrote that paper." And she insisted he had copied it from somebody else. So he very slowly walked toward the door. She said, "You're going to the principal's office right now." He walks toward the door, slams it. And at that moment, my mother said she fell in love with him. That was the beginning of the relationship. At any rate, during the 20s, 1920s, he hitchhiked around the country. He became a hobo during the Depression. He rode the freights. He was a cowboy. He almost became a pimp in Mobile, Alabama, where some women invited him to their place, and in the morning he saw they were rifling through the pants of their johns and decided, "I'm not going to stay around to be a pimp." Then he tried organizing the first union at Macy's, and this is at a time that he and my mother, their relationship was on the rocks, and it was the time of the Spanish Civil War. He was fired for having tried to start the first union at Macy's. And so he volunteered to fight against Franco on the loyalist side in the Spanish Civil War.
A lot of writers, along with a lot of other writers that did that, of course.
Yeah, I mean, like Hemingway didn't fight in the war. He was a journalist there. But he became a partisan fighter in the Basque Country, blowing up bridges and trains. He then was recruited by Commissar Vera, a Russian commissar, because of the loyalist side. It was largely, a lot of it was run by communists under kind of Stalin. It was really a war, to a certain extent, between Stalin and Hitler, and Mussolini. And Hitler was using the Spanish Civil War to test out his new Luftwaffe and the Panzer divisions against the loyalists. And you all know of Picasso's Guernica, which was showing the atrocity of the bombing that was occurring at that time. My dad came down from the hills in the Battle of Madrid. He fought in the war. He got shot like an inch from his groin. He said to me as a kid, "One more inch, Pete, and you wouldn't have been born." So he fights there. Now she, Commissar Vera, trains him to be a spy and to go back to America and to watch the docks and to make sure the wealthy capitalists weren't sending arms and munitions to Hitler and Franco. She never contacted him, though. And he thinks, once he got back to the United States, and he thinks that it's probably because he was such a maverick in his own mind. He's a very independent thinker. And he couldn't just go along with the kind of Soviet game plan of what they wanted him to believe and think and do. And so he came back to New York. Prior to that, he'd been trying to write horror stories unsuccessfully. He's a bouncer here at the Cuban Village. He and my mother have sort of reconciled, and they decide to have a baby. I'm supposed to be the patchwork to hold their marriage together. I fail miserably. It does not work. So he's a bouncer here, and he submits a story to Black Mask magazine.
A nonfiction story.
A nonfiction called "I Guard Nudes," because that's what he did at the Cuban Village. He would put shawls around the dancers and protect them from guys who were drunk and trying to paw them. He did that, and after that was published in Black Mask, his career as a detective story writer just took off. And his agent was Cap Shaw, and he loved Cap Shaw. And he just started publishing like crazy. So many Cash Whale stories. He had some other heroes as well, but Cash Whale and Sailor Duffy were his main characters.
We might mention, as far as the horror stories go, keep in mind, if he was trying to write for the Shudder Pulps in 1939 and 1940, they were done. They had given into censorship pressure, so perhaps the kind of horror story that he wanted to write, there was no market for in 39 and 40. However, if you look at some of the Cash Whale stories, there are definitely some horrific elements in those, which kind of Lynn Creech, that whole idea of him trying to be a horror writer. Now, he did not have Joseph Shaw as his agent when he sold I, Guard Nudes.
Right.
He picked him up pretty quickly after that. Fanny Ellsworth, we talked about Fanny Ellsworth last night at Pro Distributors, was the editor of Black Mask at the time. And she nurtured him, and you think perhaps she's the one that introduced him to Cab Shaw?
Yes, I think so. I think that's how it happened.
And so he continued. Could you, before we go on from that, there's a story that you told about how he looked at stories writing as like games, and could you bring in that checker story?
Yeah, yeah. He was a champion. He loved crossword puzzles, and he loved playing chess, but he was a master at checkers. In fact, he told me a story where he taught Sidney Franklin, the Brooklyn American bullfighter in Spain, when he was in Spain, to play checkers in exchange for Franklin, teaching him a little bit how to bullfight there. But behind New York City Public Library in Bryant Park, there would be all of these checker games set up, maybe 15 of them, and he would go around to each one and play each one by one, and he would inevitably win. I mean, he was that good at doing something like that. So that's something that happened.
And we should also mention that when Peter was born, 1941, he was named after Peter Page.
Yeah.
After his dad's nom de plume. You don't know where the page comes from, though, right?
I don't know where P-A-I-G-E comes from. Mm-hmm. No.
And you said he never mentioned Ken White, because by this time, 41, it had been taken over by Popular Publications. Mm-hmm. Kenneth White was his editor. Fanny Ellsworth was no longer his editor.
Yeah.
But he never mentioned anyone. And his, you said, was a solitary profession. A lot of these guys hung out with one another. He didn't hang out with other pulp writers.
He didn't know anybody else. I mean, he didn't hang out with them. He didn't have commerce with them in any respect. He really wrote solely alone in this Bronx apartment where we lived. So I, as I said, failed to hold their marriage together. My mother and dad divorced when I was 1 year of age. And the divorce occurred mainly because World War II had broken out. He'd already been publishing detective stories, and he decided to volunteer for the Army Air Force. Mm-hmm. And they kept sending him to various schools. He was very intelligent. He never got to see action in the Spanish, in the American War, World War II, as he did in Spain. And he met his second wife while he was in the Army in Florida, and married her, and had a second child. He's now in California, and there he is on the left. That's my dad on the left. There's his second child in the middle, Lori, and that's his brother on the right, who's 10 years younger than him. And he's publishing detective stories, and his second wife is a very good editor, he told me. She really helped him with his manuscripts, which was quite interesting. Let's see what we have next. So that's him playing chess, and he could really focus, I mean, just on the game, what have you. He would routinely solve the New York Times double cross stick, the Sunday New York Times double cross stick, which was one of the most difficult crossword puzzles to solve.
So if you don't see any Peter Page stories in any of the pulps from December 43 to July of 1945, it's because he was in the service at that time and was not writing.
Yeah.
And ended up on the West Coast. Now, at the age of five, when you're five in 46, yeah, he's writing, he's in a pretty good stretch for Black Mask and for his pulp stories. And he comes back into your life.
He comes back into my life.
And you knew that he was writing pulp stories.
Well, not at five, but a little after, probably when I'm seven or eight, I become aware of that. And we'd go on the street and we'd go to newsstands, and then I'd see the cover there, basically, that was was based on the story that he had in that Dime Detective magazine. And it would be very, very exciting. And he'd be there right in a way, and I'd be very excited to have him, like at the end of each day, to wish that there are pages coming out of that typewriter of his, that royal typewriter that he wrote with. So that was, you know, very intriguing to me, and he had always identified with being a writer. It's the most important thing in the world to him. And then it was what, in the early 50s or so, when I was about 12 years old, I went to live with him. I stopped living with my mother and my stepfather and lived with him on a permanent basis. But by that time, the pulps had pretty much died. And he was told by Cap Shaw, he said, hey, why don't you go write a novel, you know? And he had other people telling him, you know, to not just write the pulp stuff as if that wasn't that important, but to go write, so, the great American novel. So he spent the next years writing, trying to write the great American novel, unsuccessfully. And he ends up writing three or four of them. And it's not till he's 74 years old, or just a little older, in 1988, that he takes Softly Creep and Softly Kill, that story that he published in the pulps, and he extrapolated that into The Nightmare Blonde, which got published then.
Now, in those days, he was, however, writing for Manhunt in the early 50s. He did some Manhunt stories, and one of them was adapted into a TV.
Yeah.
A TV movie with William Bendix, I believe?
With William Bendix, and it was for the Jane Wyman Fireside Theater. Steve Fisher adapted his story to that, but when I finally saw it, I was very disappointed because The Attacker, which I thought was a fantastic story, in which this policeman is, again, it's a blonde woman who is dying all the time, and this killer is, it's a rainy day, and that's the circumstance in which she ends up dead. Someone's killed her, and he feels he's getting closer and closer to catching the killer, but as the story proceeds, you realize that he's the killer, and he's not aware of it. He's sort of dissociated from his own murderous impulses. And at the end of the story, it's basically like I'm sure I'm gonna find him. I'm really close right now. But it's really having to discover that it was he then that did it. In the Fireside Theater version of it, they don't have the policeman, played by William Bendix, as the killer, and they blame it on some other guy, which lost the entire point.
Yeah.
Of The Attacker, which was so exciting to me.
And that was a pretty famous story. It was anthologized a few times, and in addition to being made into it.
It was put into the best detective stories of the past 75 years in that anthology. So it really...
Could you talk a little bit about a couple of the novels that he... The premise behind a couple of the novels that he tried to do?
The first novel he tried to do, he called Wigger. And then he felt, oh no, you know, Wigger instead of the N-word. And the idea of Wigger was that civilization had developed in North Africa rather than Eastern Europe. That Hannibal had successfully crossed the Alps, defeated the Romans. And so the whites were the minority race, and the blacks were the majority race, Wigger. He changed the title to Native You. The idea was a very catchy idea, but he couldn't extrapolate it in a way. He finished the book, but I read it recently, thoroughly, and it was very experienced, distant, intellectual. It wasn't like his Cash Whale stories, which were full of grit. And you had characterized the Cash Whale stories. Why don't you tell them what you thought of those stories?
Well, the Cash Whale stories, and you guys that have read Cash Whale know that even though it was sort of created after the Ellsworth shift, and there was a lot of psychological stuff, which we'll talk about your dad, his psychological things in these stories, that's some of the hardest boiled characters ever, Cash Whale and Sailor Duffy. They're very tough. There's a lot of violence, there's a lot of cynicism, and this was not that way, you said, right?
And there's a lot of humor.
Yeah,
I think that's what Walker, you like the humor in his stories, mm-hmm. you said.
Yeah, yeah. What about other novels?
He wrote a novel called Bluff. And Bluff, my dad won our TV set on a game show, a TV game show called Tic-Tac-Dome. And he was just up to being the next contestant on the $64,000 question just before that was busted. They realized the whole thing was being faked and went off. So he never got a chance to really participate in that show. And Bluff was about that, basically, how you can figure out how they were giving the answers to the contestants and what the ruse was in that particular story. So that was another story that he had that was not published. He had one called The Nightmare Bullet, mm-hmm. and the notion was that you could have in a bullet, in effect, an atomic weapon, where you could just shoot somebody and it would be like an atomic weapon. And a nuclear scientist from Germany had come to the United States, and the Russians were trying to capture this guy for themselves. And it was a very complicated plot, kind of interesting. A lot of what he would call hugger-mugger from the old days, but that never flew. He wrote a couple of others that did not go, but he was always writing short stories. And as I said, he got some published in Manhunt, some in Ellery Queen. And then as he aged, he continued writing short stories. So I've got a whole bunch of unpublished short stories, some of which are excellent, mm-hmm. that I'm trying to get published in some way.
We should mention also, Peter, that in 1952, Cap Shaw, Joseph T. Shaw, died. And instead of going out and getting another agent, your dad decided not to. In fact, his only agent ever in his life was Cap Shaw.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why was that? Why did he not try and seek another agent?
I don't know. I think he wanted to just do it on his own, mm-hmm. and thought he could. My dad was a rather self-important guy, a bit narcissistic, and thought that he could just handle all of that. He didn't need that kind of help to some extent, but I think it upended him, basically. Mm-hmm. It hurt him in not being able to have help publishing.
What did he do? Would you recall him talking about Cap Shaw and what he would say, what he said about Cap Shaw? I assume he was very close.
Well, he loved Cap Shaw. He had nothing but kind things to say about him, he said. But again, I didn't know, he didn't really share that much with me about his process. It was something I observed a little bit from afar as he was trying to write the great American novel. Again, I mean, just the notion that, boy, if we could sell this book, I'd get 50,000 bucks. He was basically being supported to some extent by my grandmother, who owned the pharmacy, and with whom he lived in the Bronx, and me, when I went to live with them. So eventually, he needed money so much that he went out and he started selling welcome wagon advertisements for local stores to make some money. He worked for an insurance company. He sold the great books of the Western world, which I did for one summer. And then he got involved, he worked for a lumber company, and then he got involved in an unfinished furniture store, and eventually established his own unfinished furniture store in New York City. Walker Martin met him in 1980 there, had heard about him, and got to know him that way. And then he got another store. So that basically was the way he earned money.
But he always continued writing.
Always wrote.
Yeah.
And then eventually, when he was, you know, really up there in age, I got him and his wife, his third wife, who he was madly in love with. And let me see if that's a picture of him with a Greek fishing hat. And that's his third wife on the left, Gay. And that's my dad on the right. And in the middle is his first cousin, Leo, who was chief aeronautical engineer at Lockheed Aircraft. He designed effectively the F-104, the Starfighter, which was the fastest plane in the world for a while, the F-104. And he would kind of taunt Leo because he was into solipsism, Bishop Berkeley's theory of solipsism, where you could where it was a kind of intellectual rationalization where you could not prove there was an external reality because we process everything through our senses internally. All we know is what's happening in our mind this way. So how do we really know that there's anything out there? And you know, that is actually real apart from how we are internally processing things. So he loved solipsism. He loved his favorite theory about human behavior was everyone follows their course of least resistance according to their particular composition, which is like saying what is. You know, I mean, that explains everything, but it doesn't give you a theory or a hypothesis that you can test. It's tautological to a great extent. And he was interested in Kant's windowless monads, which John got a little, I think, tired of.
I'm still working with that, yeah.
It's
quite a, it was philosopher in some ways, right? I
mean, yeah.
Did we lose the slide?
Mike lost the slide.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was also into Buddhism as a kid. And he went to a camp in New York City when he was in high school where Harrison Tweed, a very wealthy lawyer, entrepreneur, brought kids, poor New York City kids that showed talent in various ways, out to his home in Montauk Point in Long Island and exposed them to the greatest exemplars of the arts, of science, of literature. Paul Lukes, the artist, was out there. And Mort, because he was so interested in Buddhism, was known as Buddha out there. And so when he was 16, he convinced Harrison Tweed to send him on a boat, a merchant marine boat, to Calcutta because he wanted to meet the head Buddhist in the world, which he ended up doing. And he ended up asking him a question. He said, hey, if Buddhism is so caring about people and that's part of its philosophy, why doesn't it support the ideal of communism from each according to his needs, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs? And this head Buddhist said, well, that's a very good question, and I'll have to think about that. And at that point, the fact that he couldn't answer Mort's question, Mort immediately concluded, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And he gave up his belief in Buddhism instantly at that point. So
The photos are back. This photo, I believe, Peter, was 1988, about the time The Nightmare Blonde was published.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about The Nightmare Blonde a little bit. It was based on a Detective Tales short story, as we've talked about.
Yeah.
Do you recall how he felt? Was this a triumph for him to finally get a book out?
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I felt he was very excited about it, that he finally published a book.
It was Pocket Books that did it, so it was a legit, it was a paperback original.
Yeah, and right. Pocket Books labeled it a horror story, when in fact it was a detective story. Mm-hmm. It had horror in it. But the main thing, it was a whodunit, and a difficult thing to suss out and discern who the killer was.
So yeah. A couple more photos.
Okay. Yeah. So that's him with his stepdaughter, Gay's daughter, Anna Linda. And here, as you see, he's a bit older. This is him and me. We're at the Ritz-Carlton in Laguna Hills, a beautiful hotel that's on a cliff. And let's see, and that's his memorial, celebration of life when he died. And a picture of him there.
And he was 89 when he died?
He died when he was 89 of congestive heart failure.
Was he still writing up to the end?
Yeah, he was writing up to the end.
Yeah.
And this is Matt Moring's volume 2 of the Cash Whale books. And then just recently, as I said, The Nightmare Blonde was published on July 60, republished by Encyclopocalypse Publications, Mark Miller.
And that is the original cover to the pocketbook, right?
That's the original cover that's now on the new book as well.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Yeah. And are there going to be other, is Encyclopocalypse going to publish other of his unpublished manuscripts?
Yeah, well, Encyclopocalypse is, Mark Miller is interested in publishing his unpublished stuff. Okay. So I'm trying to get that to happen. Because for me, it's one of the interesting things about Pulpfest is so many of you have told me just how important it was to go back to childhood, you know, and the things that affected you so deeply as kids and that you loved and are sort of re-experiencing as you read these books and collect them. And for me, in a sense, this is similar. Just the sense of being in touch with my dad again. Mm-hmm. And he was my savior. I'm a psychoanalyst. And you might ask why I became a psychoanalyst. You know that all therapists are crazy, right? So I had problems when I was between 1 and 5. I was an extremely depressed kid, and his brother said, "Hey, Mort, you got to come back here. Pete's in trouble." When he came back from California, and I didn't have any male role models to look up to and to absorb. My mother was at work to earn money, and so I felt very much lost and abandoned. I was an only child, and he came back, and I just absorbed him like a sponge. He loved kids. He loved kids better than adults, and he would teach kids chess and play games. He was a phenomenal raconteur, a charismatic speaker. They loved to hear him, and he wouldn't let me stay depressed. I'd be in one of my moods, you know, depressive moods. And the thing that I dreamed about as a kid was that I'd be in prison because at least they fed you and took care of you in prison, or spend the rest of my life in a movie house. So I'd get depressed in his presence, and he'd sort of crack a joke, or he'd be with me. He wouldn't let me stay depressed, you know, and where I'd end up laughing and coming out of it. And he was very positive. He always believed in my capacity to do things in life. And because I was surrounded by older kids where I lived and kind of picked on, and he was angry, you know, that was, he taught me how to fight. He put a pillow in front of me and taught me how to jab. And that jabbing was the most important thing about boxing. He exercised every day, and I began to exercise and got in the habit of that and taking care of myself. So I always felt that he believed in me. And years later, when I was like at the Ritz-Carlton, what have you, he confided in me that he felt really hopeless about me, but that he knew that that wouldn't help me at all. So he acted as if, and he related to me as if he had the fullest confidence in the world that I could make something of myself and be somebody. And I'm so glad that he did. You know, sometimes, you know, it's a white lie. It's an important thing to do things to help people when it's not always just the truthful thing of what you feel. So he was my best therapist. And I, when I grew up and decided what I wanted to do in life, I thought there could be nothing more important for me than to do as a therapist what he did for me. How important he was, how he helped me transform myself from being this hopeless, depressed little kid into feeling very positive about life, having a good life.
So, you kind of got the writing thing too, though, from him.
You've read
your own book.
Yeah, well, originally I wanted to be a therapist also. What a great source material for stories. But eventually I became too enamored with the profession and the various questions within the profession that concerned me as a clinician, and I began writing clinically for professional psychoanalytic journals. I did that, and then I became, because he was a very politically oriented guy, always had the radio on, news programs, He was very cultured. He loved Renata Tibaldi. If she was singing, the opera singer, everybody had to be quiet in the household. So I ended up getting very angry when George McGovern's choice for vice president, Thomas Eagleton, in 1972, I was a new staff psychologist at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, very angry when it was discovered that he had a psychiatric history, that he had been institutionalized, he'd had ECT, and people were saying, "Why? How could you trust a psycho an inch from the red phone during the Cold War and possibly start a nuclear holocaust?" And I, in this piece, I defended Eagleton for hiding it, for lying, for a sin of omission, because the public doesn't really know how to assess this. They have psychophobia, a fear of the psychological, a fear of being crazy. You know, Bobby Burns said, "Everybody's a little daft except ye and me, and sometimes I wonder about ye." You know, that's like all of us, right? So I wrote this virulent op-ed piece unsolicited to the LA Times. The next week, I got a check for $150. It was published a week later in the Sunday Times, and I was working at St. John's Hospital, a Catholic hospital. The nuns were in charge of it, Sister Mary Alouise. So it comes out on Sunday. Monday, I'm going to go back to the school. I think I'm going to get fired. You're going to see that I encourage people to lie, to be, quotes, immoral, what have you. I go there, and the first thing in the morning, Sister Mary Alouise wants to speak to you. So she comes down, this little nun in a habit, and I look at her, and she breaks out in this broad smile and shakes my hand and says, "Congratulations, thank you." And I'd forgotten that, you know, Catholics are so much, so charitable and giving to the poor and working with the physically and the mentally handicapped. I mean, that was part of her faith and her ideology. It was wonderful. But it took me 27 years before I published my second op-ed piece in the LA Times. I got the attention of the chief editor, and it was about why the most Republican of all Democratic presidential candidates was being so virulently persecuted by Republicans. And at that time, it seemed like that was happening to me. So I used Freud's concept of the narcissism of minor differences, because Bill Clinton was a Republicrat. He incorporated a lot of the Republicans' political planks as his ideology. He was stealing their thunder, in essence. He was co-opting their existence at the time. And in order to politically survive, I think a number of them felt they had to kill him. Plus, there was also the psychoanalytic concept. The people who were attacking him virulently, you know, for his Lothario stuff and his Monica Lewinsky and his peccadilloes, were doing the same thing. Henry Hyde, others were. It was projective identification. They were projecting into him what they were doing. And it was the superego, morality. How awful he is, in the service of the id, in the service of aggression. So I used those two concepts. Alison Silver, the chief editor of the LA Times, was excited about that. She published the article, and then she said she wanted me to write for her. So I published like seven other op-ed pieces that were psychoanalytically oriented, illustrating the deeper unconscious motivation for political events and politicians' behavior. And ultimately wrote for her, wrote for the Huffington Post, for Thomson Reuters, and Counterpunch. And altogether, I published about 27 of those pieces and put them in a book in 2019. And the book was published as Psychoanalysis Enters the Political Fray. And that was what the book was about.
I don't want to, this last question.
Okay.
And I don't think we prepared for this, so excuse me for...
No, I'd love to be surprised.
I would like to know if you were to write a piece about PopeCon, Pope Fest, What would be your approach? I mean, I know you were probably surprised by some of the things. What would you say about the experience you've had coming to conventions and meeting Pulp fans and the people who love your dad's work and just love Pulps in general? What would you say?
I mean, for me, this has been a wonderful experience. What struck me the most was your passion about what you collect and your intense motivation to relate to stuff from your own past, from stories that intrigue you, from fantasy, retaining your own youthfulness in that sense. As you age even, and as you get older, you're still going back to the stuff you loved as kids to a great extent. And it's enlivening. I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. And so I am extraordinarily impressed with what you do and how you do it.
Thank you guys very much. Dr. Peter Lewis.
Thank you.
Yeah, we would have time for maybe one or two questions if anybody has any questions. We've got about 5 minutes before we have to get out of here because one of the things you learn about Pulp Fest, don't get in the way of the auction. Never get in the way of the auction. Yeah, David.
There's a very funny, unique kind of quality in your father's writing that I wonder if you could, you know, talk about the source or something like that. But it, along with the humor and the brutality, it seems like he has a forgiving nature or something, because it seems non-judgmental almost, mm-hmm. you know. So it's unique a little bit to me, because I showed it to my son, who's 30, and he read the first one I gave him, and we were just talking about it. But I was just, I said, you know, it's super violent, so get ready for that. It's kind of, and so he thought, oh, it's going to be like the horror kind of thing or something like that. But and I said, but it's also really funny. And he was like, well, like the Three Stooges or something like that. But then, you know, the more I thought about it afterwards, it's like they only go together because he seems to be really to like people or something.
He was, I think, a very caring person. A very loving person. I certainly felt that. The kids in my neighborhood felt it. Many of them felt he was like their father figure. He'd come out to the ballpark and watch the games and admire the good athletes or the, you know, just the people there and related to them, him almost like their father. So I think he had that in him also. That was the most beneficial thing actually about him. But he was a tough, manly, adventurous guy also, you know, which was, you know, very interesting. And he was very self-reflective. He got me to think about myself. I was having trouble with my mother and stepfather, and he got me to think analytically about them, of what was motivating them and why maybe they were the way they were. I mean, in a certain way, incredible.
Usually communist-leaning people are extremely judgmental.
Yes. I mean, they're, I mean, when you're part of a cult, you know, which in a certain way communism is, either a cult on the left or the right, of any kind of cult, you're going to be judgmental of anybody who's different, who's not like you. And he was very broadly accepting, except, you know, I mean, it's very interesting about the communist thing. George Orwell's, what's the name of the book about Catalonia? George Orwell was not a Stalinist, and he was much more Trotskyite. And Mort's daughter, actually, influenced by Mort, becomes a Trotskyite. Not, you know, I mean, little girl, you saw a picture of her, she was a forklifter, she was a conductor on a railroad, but he was a bit intolerant at that. I mean, he departed with communism big time with the invasion of Eastern Europe and just felt that was an atrocity. But he never was a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. My mother was. And my mother, she was a shy woman. And probably the greatest benefit of the Communist Party for her was it was a form of assertiveness training, where she could speak out in front of groups and have her own voice, and became more self-confident in doing that.
But just like for a bit, like Sailor Duffy as a character, strangely brutal to an extreme degree,
And
yet it's an extremely loving portrayal of this character.
Yeah. It was a real mix, right, between love and hate, and
And an acceptance, of course, by Cash Whale of Sailor. I mean, there's that relationship is a very interesting.
Totally.
As you say, there's a very interesting relationship between those two characters. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are, pulp, hardboiled pulp is full of this the kind of thing. You think about D.L. Champion stuff, where you've always got the narrator and then the hero, but this is a little bit the dynamics of the relationship. It's a little different than
absolutely
usual polls, yeah. Okay, we think we're done then. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. Brought to you by The Pulp Net. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more. At the PulpNet, your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years, online at thepulp.net. Subscribe to Pulp Tales on your favorite podcast platform, or listen to us on the web at thepulp.net. If you enjoy our content, please like us or leave us a review, and tell your fellow pulp fans about Pulp Tales. Thank you for listening, and keep reading the pulps. Pulp Tales is copyright 2024 by William P. Lampkin.